On This Week in Enterprise Tech, your patched Android device may not actually be patched. Your router has been assimilated. Bitcoin mining down under. Do you own the gear that you've bought? And VMware is bringing virtualized security to hospitals. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 286, recorded April 13th, 2018, VMware in healthcare. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Drive brand awareness, generate leads, and build long-term purposeful relationships with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, visit linkedin.com/Twyatt. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's a show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with our chief progenitor. That's right, folks. He's got baby number 4, Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, so Microsoft has a new baby division, right?
I'm going to actually start staffing that division pretty soon, so we'll see.
This is kind of amazing because when you were first on Twyatt, episode 3, as a guest, you were in studio and you had one baby. That wasn't that long ago. So, I mean, you've been working on revisions.
Multiple revisions. I think we've got it right now. So we'll see what we'll deliver.
Yeah. So release 5.0 is probably at least a couple of years off in the future. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
But okay, we got to do it. You got to show at least one picture of the baby because otherwise there's going to be people saying, "Wait a minute, baby." Yes, that's right, folks. We've got a little Lou. Oh my gosh. our TD is a little cynical when it comes to the cost of babies, but okay, we'll go. Lou, congratulations. But of course, it's not just Lou. I've got my very good friend who is currently, I'm going to say homeless. Yeah, he's homeless because he's going from house to house. He's trying to find his place. That's right. It's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how's the house hunt?
Well, the house hunt may well be over. It looks like we are in process. The process of buying a house requires pound upon pound of papers to be passed back and forth. We're in the process of doing that. So ideally, and with a little bit of luck, before too long, I'll be coming to you from a new studio in the City Beautiful. Made sure that we've got space for a good studio in the new house, and it's going to be very nice. But before I do that, I've got to get ready because next week I'm going to be in the city by the bay out at RSA and looking forward to all kinds of scary security goodness out there.
Yeah, and I should be joining you, except I will be on a plane heading back across the Atlantic, which is kind of a bummer. Now, I thought housing was supposed to be easy. I mean, you like the house, you shake hands, and the house is yours. They give you the keys, right? That's how it works.
Well, you that's the simplified version. So that's how it works if you're programming house buying in BASIC. Unfortunately, most realtors and banks do it in assembler. And so there are just a few more steps thrown in because we like it that way.
Well, gentlemen, we've got quite a show for our audience. Not only are we going to be doing the blips and the bytes and bringing people up to date with what's going on in the world of enterprise technology, but we've got a special guest. We're bringing in someone who can tell us a little bit about virtualizing healthcare. No, it's a little bit of a tease, I know, but you're going to want to stick around, trust me. But as we always do, we need to kick it off with the blips. Now, it wasn't too long ago that bring your own device was a hot enterprise topic. Admins and CTOs debated the pros and cons of opening up their networks to allow users to bring in their own gear to do official company work. Well, that debate is over, and BYOD is now just accepted as a regular part of doing business, in large part because device manufacturers have gotten better about making sure that their security is solid enough to pass enterprise spec. And that would be that. Except for the fact that a new study by Security Research Labs seems to show that many of those manufacturers are lying about what they've patched. SRL tested 1,200 phones from a dozen different manufacturers, including Samsung, Google, Motorola, HTC, LG, Xiaomi, OnePlus, Nokia, TCL, and ZTE. They found that only the Google Pixel phone had every patch that the manufacturers claimed the device had. Aside from Google, Samsung and Sony devices on average missed the least, with between zero and one missing patch. OnePlus and Nokia did a little worse, with 1 to 3 missing patches, while TCL and ZTE were dead last, with an average of 4 or more claimed patches missing from their OS. Looking deeper into the data, it seems that some manufacturers have been playing it loose with what patched means, with them opting to remove the features associated with the vulnerability instead of actually patching the vulnerability, a move that could still leave exploitable gaps in security. This has serious enterprise implications, as many BYOD security policies are based off manufacturers' release data about vulnerabilities and patch cycles. If a manufacturer is out and out lying about the work that they've done to secure their devices, it would mean at minimum that responsible enterprise would have to do their own unit-by-unit security audit. At worst, it might be time to reopen in the case for banning BYOD.
Are you ready for quantum safe certificates? Well, Cisco is one of the companies that wants to know the answer. Cisco Systems and security firm Asara are collaborating to test digital certificates able to work in conventional public key cryptography as well as quantum computing environments. They would like to find that a single certificate can work in both environments, but, well, right now that remains to be proven. Traditional crypto certificates just aren't secure enough to authenticate transactions in a quantum environment due to the sheer speed of quantum calculations. So, during the migration from traditional computers to quantum computing, digital certificates will need to be equipped to support both computing environments, which in practical terms means supporting multiple encryption mechanisms for each certificate. To demonstrate the viability of the approach, Cisco and Asara have set up a public server that uses the so-called PQ Hybrid X.509 certificates, and PQ stands for post-quantum, to authenticate to the transport layer security clients. The collaboration began with a focus on the use of quantum safe authentication scheme called LMS, or Leighton-Macaulay signatures. The next phase, now that will introduce support for additional algorithms.
So we all know that our devices, especially IoT devices, are vulnerable to attacks due to small amounts of investments that the industry has put into security. There have been security researchers out there that we talked about our home routers being exploited and so on, but the claims have been mainly academic. But what we haven't seen yet is the massive attack or exploits of epic proportions. Well, surprise, this past week, Akamai has published new findings that they've observed attacks of routers and video game consoles that are actively exploiting some of the security holes in our devices, especially in older network protocols like Universal Plug and Play, or UNP. What are they doing? Well, they're using these simple weaknesses as a jump point for all sorts of malicious behavior, which could include DDoS attacks, malware distribution, spamming, phishing, account takeovers, click fraud, and credit card theft. Remember in the movie Sneakers when they bounced the call off of relays and satellites to mask their calls to the FBI? Well, hackers are using your devices to do the same thing. They're creating elaborate proxy chains that cover their malicious tracks and create what Akamai calls multi-purpose proxy botnets. Because devices are all different and have different versions of firmware, they don't auto-update or patch to fix or fix the vulnerabilities. Hackers are always able to attack any surface, and that surface will continue to grow until and over time, actually. Akamai says it found 4.8 million devices on the open internet that would improperly return a certain query related to UMPMP. Of those, 765,000 also has a secondary implementation issue that created a bigger network communication vulnerability. And then on more than 65,000 of those, Akamai saw evidence that hackers had exploited the other weaknesses to inject one or more malicious commands into the router mechanism that controls traffic flow. The final 65,000 devices were grouped together in various ways and ultimately pointed to about 16,000 or 17,000 unique IP addresses for attackers to bounce traffic around to mask their movements. To stop the bleeding, your business and yourself can disable universal plug and play, on your devices as well as turn off forwarding, reset passwords, disable NAT, and also try to keep your devices up to date. Do your best to stay on top of those updates.
Trust no one. Now, according to a new Gartner report, spending on the security component of IoT alone is going to hit $1.5 billion by the end of 2018, with the total IoT spending in the multiples of billions. Perhaps it's then no surprise that Splunk, a darling of IT admins looking to unlock the data in their logs, is looking for a piece of that fortune. Splunk has announced a series of partnerships to help them analyze data from industrial IoT devices with a product that they're calling Industrial Asset Intelligence. Built off of their Splunk Enterprise platform, the product uses Splunk's expertise in log analysis to provide actionable intelligence for customers who use IoT technology to monitor and control industrial equipment. Now, the road won't be easy. Splunk is stepping into a market that is currently dominated by IBM, GE, and Siemens, companies with decades of experience advantage over Splunk in industrial control and big data analytics. But they've already shown early success with trial customers like DB Cargo, a European rail freight company, and Shaw Industries, which makes flooring. Pricing is not yet available, but a free limited access period will start on April 23rd for those wanting to test the new software.
It's no surprise that cyber attacks are still common. It is surprising that it's still taking way too long to discover the damage. According to data from two new studies released this week, cybersecurity teams are going to have to get 100 times faster at finding successful attacks if they want to prevent most damage. According to FireEye Mandiant's 2018 M-Trends report, the most recently measured dwell time, and that's the time between the initial attack and its discovery, equals an average of about 101 days for organizations worldwide. Bad news is that's up 2 days since last year, but if you're looking for good news, it's that the number has come down significantly from 416 days back in 2011. The time from first action in an event chain to initial compromise of an asset is often measured in seconds or minutes, so a delay of more than 3 months in figuring out that it's happening is very scary indeed. And here's the thing. Remember that the time to discovery is just the start of the journey in responding to a compromise. There's also the time it takes to respond to, contain, and investigate the threat. According to a LogRhythm study, fewer than one-third of organizations say that even if they detected a major incident, they'd be able to contain it within an hour.
A group of security specialists who work for the U.S. government, together with a former Apple engineer, founded the company Grayshift, which is now selling a solution called GrayKey, which we heard about last month. GrayKey is a device with a turnkey method for unlocking most of the iPhone, iPad, and iPod models on the market today. The list of features includes unlocking deactivated phones, breaking 4 to 6 digit PINs, full file system copying, and compatibility with the latest iOS versions. There is no evidence that this has even worked up until date or that the government actors even cared about it, but based on GrayKey's new pricing model and some news from local and federal government agencies, it seems to be targeting government agencies and businesses. Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department have received quotes from Grayshift. Secret Service has communications and have talked about the purchase orders on the device. The State Department has purchased the device, and the DEAs around the country are also. Grayshift has put together a pricing model where it has two pricing tiers, a web version that can be used for unlocking 300 unique devices at a mere $15,000 per year. They also offer an offline version that can be used for unlocking unlocking unlimited devices for just $30,000 a year. What devices? Well, iPhone 5S all the way up to iPhone 8 and iPhone X, including all the devices using iOS 10 and iOS 11. Is GrayKey the only solution on the market? Nope. An Israeli company named Cellebrite, who came to the public attention a few years ago to offer unlocking services for iPhone 5 for the U.S., has recently launched a similar solution. It was founded that the FBI actually bought $2 million worth of forensic tools from Cellebrite in the past, and we can only guess what they're using them for. Apple has yet to publicly react to the vulnerabilities that they allow for unlocking. Even though this is a bit scary in today's privacy landscape, this seems to be a ticking time bomb type of backdoor, since the process will be a phone is released, companies such as Grayshift look for ways to access the device. For a time, their tools and exploits work, and then the phone manufacturer issues a fix, plugs the hole in the new operating system version, and everything goes away. Rinse and repeat the cycle. The best thing for you to ensure your passwords are long enough, hold back things that you don't want to put on your phone, obviously. Make sure your passwords are 15-plus characters or something harder, remote wipe enable wipe, especially when you lose it. But I think it might be time for Apple to implement some kind of a duress fingerprint, a passcode or passpin, which is like a silent alarm that will wipe the phone in about X amounts of seconds. This will kind of be like this message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
Now, in the past few weeks, we've heard a few stories about Bitcoin mining companies moving around to find the underutilized power grids and the best possible energy rates. Now, most of the stories have ended with angry locals wondering why they were subsidizing the power needs of out-of-towners who were contributing nothing to the local economy. Outrage, rinse, repeat. Well, one company has looked at the power problem and come up with a novel solution. Instead of moving around to find towns and cities with cheap power, why not just move into the power plant? That's what Australia-based IoT Group is doing with the Blockchain Application Center. It's an initiative to reopen shuttered coal-fired plants to sell the power to companies that are offering blockchain-based services at wholesale or pre-grid prices. The first such project is a partnership with Hunter Energy to recommission a power station 2 hours north of Sydney, Australia. Expected to be completed in 12 months, IoT Group is hoping to attract not just Bitcoin mining operators looking for cheap power, but also companies that are working with non-crypto uses of blockchain technology. They estimate that roughly 5% of the plant's maximum power will be used for blockchain applications, with no word on what will be done with the remainder. While this could be seen as a case of turning out-of-date power lemons into blockchain-powered lemonade, there is concern about reopening power plants that were closed for a reason, usually because they were hopelessly outdated. And in trying to build a long-term sustainable relationship with blockchain technology other than just feeding it more power. So, if you're looking to do the next great thing in blockchain, it might be time for you to go down under. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. And folks, we need to talk about your right to repair the things that you own. Or do you own them? I don't know, but we're going to find out. But first, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we here at Twit, we understand advertising because we have a certain, well, perspective on it. We know that you want to hit the customers that can actually make a difference. You don't just want to shotgun your message to everybody. That's what traditional media does. So what if I told you that there was a way to make sure that your message would get to the people who might need it the most, the people for whom it might make a difference for your company? Well, that's exactly what I'm telling you, and that's exactly what you can do with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Now, LinkedIn Marketing Solutions is the best way to market your business because it's all about connecting you with the right audience when your message will resonate the most. Now, if you want to target your customers where they are every day and where they're ready to make a decision, LinkedIn can help. When you advertised on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, you have the opportunity to build long-term relationships with your customers. Those are relationships that often translate into high-quality leads, website traffic, and higher brand awareness. I mean, they're there for a reason. They're connected with you for a reason. They have a relationship with you. Why not use it? Now, the first step is talking to the right audience. Now, every day, over 500 million professionals engage with content on LinkedIn, and chances are your future customers are among them. LinkedIn has the right marketing tools to help you target your customers with precision, down to their job title, company name, and industry. You get better targeting, and that equals a message that your customers care about, which in turn leads to build a more trustworthy relationship with your customers. It's not a generic message for all. You can look at your customers and say, this is what they need to hear, this is what they would be most interested in, and this is what I need to tell them. That's the power of LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. In fact, 4 out of 5 customers on LinkedIn are decision makers at their companies, so you're building relationships that really truly matter. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to stop shotgunning your message. Promote your business with LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. To redeem a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit, go to linkedin.com/Twiat. That's linkedin.com/Twiat, T-W-I-E-T, for your free $100 ad credit. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and get into the bite. And this one, well, this hits kind of close to home. I'm not just an enterprise guy. I'm also a maker. I'm a DIYer. And there's always been this question of, well, do I have the right to fix my own gear? Do I have the right to actually use the things that I've bought? In fact, do I actually buy something when I give a company my money? Well, that's exactly what we're going to be talking about with the right to repair. You've seen the stickers and you've heard the stories. X company puts a label on their newfangled whatchamacallit, and it says that it will void your warranty if you open the case. Or Y company says that installing third-party software will mean that they no longer have to service the gear that they've sold you. Well, we've seen it for years, and we've heard the arguments go back and forth on why and why not that should happen. But here's the problem with all that. Evidently, that's illegal. That's the conclusion arrived at by the Federal Trade Commission this last Tuesday. They sent warning letters to six companies, which are likely, though not confirmed, to Nintendo, Sony, Hyundai, Apple, Microsoft, and Samsung. Now, the letters point out warranty terms that violate a 1975 law that governs manufacturers' warranties, specifically provisions that tie warranty coverage to a particular use of a particular product or service, and those that hurt consumers and businesses that offer competing products and services. That's what the 1975 law is supposed to do. Now, let's go ahead and do a little bit of quiet application here. Combine that with the story from last month about California's right to repair bill. They're the 18th state to introduce some sort of right to repair legislation. Now, the bill, introduced by Assemblywoman Susan Eggman, specifically called out Apple products and would require retailers and companies like Apple to allow their devices to be worked on at non-Apple stores or approved retailers. Now, coming back to this, this is all about this culture of ownership. What do you actually own? What are you actually paying for? What rights do you have when you pay your hard-earned money to get a phone or a laptop or an entertainment console or a networking switch, a router, a back-of-cabinet power supply? This is actually a big topic for the enterprise. This is not just for retail. This is for anyone who's ever put money into a project. So I want to open this up to the panel here. Let's start with you, Curtis. This has long been a sore spot for consumers because they get all the high-profile cases. They get whether or not you actually invalidate your Xbox warranty by opening it up, or they get the satisfaction of knowing that jailbreaking their iPhone is not actually illegal. But the enterprise has been dealing with this for far longer because of such strict licensing terms on hardware, where a manufacturer will basically say, yeah, you could use this for 7 years if it's on contract, but after that seventh year, basically, we're going to brick it. Why is this such an issue, and how has it been allowed to get this far? Why are we at the point where you have to have a federal agency step in and say, no, that's yours. You do with what you do with it what you want.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the enterprise, because one of the first places that this really became a huge issue involved farmers. And the issues of the software that controls the engines and other features in John Deere tractors. And John Deere actually used provisions of the DMCA to say that that code, that software, was copyrighted. It was theirs. And that if the farmers went in and tried to change it, tried to modify it in any way, that they were violating copyright and were subject to federal law. I think what we're having now is this whole discussion about what are you doing? Are we simply licensing everything from the manufacturer, whether it's something that is obviously a piece of software, or something that, like most things we get today, just has some software in it? And I think the reason that we have to have the federal agency get involved is because we have set up this competing set of interests between the manufacturers, the software publishers, and the consumers. And what we've seen over the years is, depending on who the administration is, how the agencies are being run, a pendulum that swings back and forth between favoring the rights of the corporations or favoring the rights of the consumers. Because we're starting to get some clarification about this, and yet because there are still things like DMCA to be involved, I think this is setting up what is an inevitable string of court cases that work their way through. So I'm very excited to see this. I think it's a step in the right direction, but I think it's a step on a journey that's going to take us a number of years and many, many pieces of legal process before it's resolved.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because I actually set this up in sort of a devil's advocate view, because I know it's very easy to rail on corporations. It's very easy to look at them and say, well, yeah, I paid for it. I can do anything I want with it. However, I think all of us, if we're being reasonable, understand that there's a limit to what you can do. For example, Eric Duckman in the chat room brings up the fact that you're not supposed to replace any of the chips inside of your engine control unit or in the CAN, the controller area network that runs your car, especially a modern car where everything can be controlled by the computer. Well, I understand that, because if you do modify something and it causes a crash, that's your fault. You did that. That wasn't the manufacturer giving you bad hardware. That was a change that you made. However, that's different than remember when Apple came out, when the jailbreaks were first starting to come out on the original iPhone. Their argument was that if you jailbreak your phone, you might take down the cellular network. And that flew for a very, very long time. So I get, yeah, that's that pendulum. It's like, yes, okay, I should be prevented from doing things that are going to harm people around me. But at the same time, if corporations are going to use these regulations to overreach and set themselves up for crazy profit margins, that's not okay either. Lou, let me bring you in here, because you do represent a company that has been accused in the past of using some of these draconian measures, specifically with the Xbox and with the Surface. This tension that we have to fight between making sure that customers won't do anything that will affect other people and allowing customers to do what they want with the gear that they paid for, that's got to be a constant thing over at Microsoft, right?
Yeah, I think any device company kind of runs into this kind of pendulum effect. I'm not sure what they're thinking with Microsoft perspective, but I do know that, with car companies especially, they are, they constantly offer, some companies offer the aftermarket capabilities, some companies do not, some companies embrace that, some companies do not. They kind of close the door. They use parts that are not necessarily readily available around, like for instance, if you buy a Nintendo Switch, if you want to replace the controller, tends to break fairly often. If you want to basically get that fixed, you can't, because the parts that are actually available for that particular device are not readily available on the internet anywhere. You have to actually buy a new controller. In fact, I have friends that live over in North Dakota. Lots of farming going on there, and in fact, they have these really high tech farming equipment that they do modify over time. In fact, they do put new firmware on them. There's some legislation where North Dakota is trying to block this. A couple friends over there were telling me that this is something that's big, because by modifying the firmware, they allow the devices to do different things that they need them to do, and the manufacturer doesn't actually allow that. And so there's, again, it can kind of go across to any market. But again, I think that sometimes the positives tends to sometimes outweigh the negatives here. Some companies embrace it. And they make lots of money over selling parts. I mean, they can sell parts for any prices that they want. And especially since they're coming from the manufacturer, they're considered first party. So I think it's kind of, again, like you said, it's a pendulum effect.
Yeah. And you remember that the original 1975 law specifically dealt with cars. At the time, it was standard practice for manufacturers to say you could only get your car serviced at an authorized service station. And they had all sorts of tricks, from holding back diagnostic manuals to making sure that those small repair shops couldn't actually get the tools to service engines and transmissions. And then they made you go to the more expensive place. Well, at that time, we got together as a society and as a group of lawmakers, and we said, no, that's not right. If they've got the knowledge to fix a vehicle, they should be allowed to fix the vehicle. If you paid for a car, then that company that sold it to you shouldn't be able to tell you, we will only let it run if you continue to pay us money. And we've seen analogs of that all the way down the line. I mean, let's look at inkjet printers. Inkjet printers is one of the more recent phenomenons. And then we could all go into networking switches and how those licensing arrangements from HP and Cisco are set up. However, and Lou, I want to throw this back over to you, because we've been talking a little bit about this pendulum a lot. Where is the right spot for that pendulum to land? I do want to make sure people can do what they want with the gear that they've purchased. But at the same time, especially in a more connected world, one bad device can lead to really bad ramifications. We've seen it in the blips when we were talking about routers. Really poorly maintained routers can harm the network in general. So at what point do you say the common good outweighs your need to be able to do what you want? Simple question. Kind of, super simple question.
It's almost like a religious war here. I think think about it from the open source software perspective. You know, this is a constant thing that they're constantly fighting is, you know, hey, like if the source is open, people can modify it. It tends to be more secure. It's easier to use. It's easier to expand and create new functionality and get it to do what I need it to do. But it also means that you sometimes take risks for low quality, low performance software because people don't pay attention to that when they're building these things. So again, the pendulum goes back and forth there as well. But what you're finding with open source is things tend to work out. I mean, you get more secure devices, you get more secure firmware, you get more performant applications and browser engines and that kind of thing because you're crowdsourcing that. And so that goes, let's apply that to hardware and repairing and modifying. I think that can apply there as well. You know, as long as we got to put out guides to say, hey, this is what the device is currently made of. And these are the parts you can replace it with. But if you don't do that, you just kind of say, oh, you can repair it and then don't provide anything, then you kind of risk the fact that people are going to muck things up and create issues. So again, it all depends on how this is implemented. If they just say, hey, right to repair, but then don't supply anything, you're going to create this kind of an ecosystem of negativity. And I think that you're better off just kind of going with the flow and supplying the details that needed to be there.
Right. We are running out of time, and I want to get to our guests, but one last little issue, and Curtis, I'm going to throw this over to you. I wish Tiebert was on today's show because I remember he used to run the largest repair center for Toshiba, Okidata, and Canon equipment in the Pacific, and he has stories about how difficult it was for him to get repair parts, and that's part of this, but the corollary to that is this discussion about e-waste, that right now, when you have a piece of equipment that doesn't work, the common practice is just to throw it out. And you've got organizations like iFixit and little groups here in the Silicon Valley and across the world that are into this right to repair because they don't want to see all this gear clog up landfills. How big of a concern should this be for the enterprise? We do use a lot of equipment and we tend to throw it away, you know, after 4 or 5 years, whenever our licensing agreement is up. Is it time to start looking differently at renewal cycles and repairability?
Well, I think that you just move the discussion into something that some corporations, not all, but some are uncomfortable with, and that is getting into what amounts to ethical or even moral behavior for an organization. Now, from an ethical or moral standpoint, then I think we absolutely should get into the era of talking about reuse and repairability, lengthening the time that devices can be used within an organization, and then making it so that when the first purchasers have finished them, when they're fully depreciated or their time on the cycle has come and they're being shuffled out, that another buyer can get them, that the inevitable second step is not some trash heap in a third world country where people are going to burn them and then send their children out to pick up precious metals from the smoldering heap. The phrase, there's got to be a better way, comes to mind. And so I do think that it's time to start looking at this. But it's a huge issue. What we're talking about here is one piece of a much, much larger discussion. But it's a discussion that does require looking at each piece, and I applaud this particular agency's willingness to, again, move us one step down what deserves to be a much longer and more rewarding path.
You know, it doesn't happen often, but every once in a while you get a federal agency like the Librarian of Congress or the FTC that makes a decision like this, which, you know, it will echo for decades. So kudos to you. We don't always give props, but definitely props to the FTC for this one. Well, gentlemen, we could talk forever about this. And this, again, it's a passionate spot for a lot of our audience. But I think it's time for us to move on to our guest. And we've got a great one for you. We're going to be talking a little bit about healthcare and what you do with that data in a virtualized network. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and take another moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. If you recently had to buy a home, if you recently had to take out a loan, Did you enjoy the process? Did you like going into a bank and talking to a complete random stranger, trying to prove to him or her that you were worthy of a loan, that your business idea was good, that you actually had income? Well, probably not, because that process is old. It's outdated. It's not the way we do things in a digital world. That's why I'm so happy to have Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans as a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Rocket Mortgage understood that the mortgage process had not kept up with the times. Again, we're a digital society, so why are we dragging bankers' boxes filled with old receipts to the bank? Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. They give you a client-focused technological revolution, a solution created by Quicken Loans. Now, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to my favorite part of every show, and that's when we bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And we welcome to the show Mr. Chris Logan. He is the Senior Healthcare Strategist over at VMware. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, you've got a long and storied history in the IT community. You've been in this business for 18 years, and your main focus has been delivering information security and privacy in both an operational and strategic capacity. And there's very few people who have that sort of combination of skills. But I have to ask, and I'm going to have to ask on behalf of my audience, why should I be concerned about healthcare strategies in VMware? Why does VMware have this department?
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask, and it's a very timely question because healthcare is transforming. The digital transformation that's really taking place across healthcare is providing us to really change how we can deliver healthcare in general, how we can reduce the cost and provide a better quality outcome to the patient. And that's really grounded in the fact that, first and foremost, the data has to be protected. If you think about how you walk into a healthcare setting or a provider setting today, they're going to use some form of data, whether it's generated by them or by you as the patient, to treat your sickness or your ailment. So right now, we're at this crossroads where data is the most important aspect of healthcare delivery. And VMware has been on the cutting edge of really transforming digitally just organizations in general. But now we're really starting to dip our toe into the security and the privacy aspects of it and ensuring that confidentiality and that integrity and the availability of data is there ready to be used to provide the best quality outcome for a patient.
Now, I do want to stress to our audience why this is important and why this is unique, because we've talked about a lot of data solutions over the years, over the hundreds of episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. But normally when we talk about a company and how it deals with data, it's about the technology and then they move to securing the data. Your expertise is the other way around, and that's what I like about it so much, which is you were concerned about the security of the data first, and then you moved to the technology. And I think this probably comes from your history of leading, what was it, the College of Healthcare Information Management Executives, because you recognize that not all data is the same. And when you're dealing with healthcare information, protected information, incredibly sensitive information, there's a different level of attention you need to have when you're developing a data solution. Give us some examples of why that's different.
Well, that's a great question. And I think it really relies in the, or it comes back to the fact that I take the standpoint that not every workload requires Fort Knox level security. And it really requires an organization to understand the data that they have at their hands. And that's where VMware really starts to make a difference, because we provide visibility into those workloads that people didn't have before. Think about the current model for security across the industry. It's primarily focused on chasing bad. And if you think about healthcare and where we've come from a digital transformation aspect, is that we have a lot of legacy-based applications. There was an explosion of consumerism that took place. There was kind of a forced transition to electronic health records without the thought process that security mattered. And what they left out with all of those elements is that security was bolted on the back end. So a lot of organizations, when they started to adopt security or look at solutions to protect data, they were really only taking advantage of 20% of the solutions that they were putting in place. We're turning that completely upside down and not allowing the chasing bad to continue happening, but we're actually architecting security into the platform. And the beauty about that in that platform, as you know from virtualization, that virtualized infrastructure, it really allows us to adopt the concept of least privilege. And it's not just for the user at this point in time, it's also for the workflows and for those devices that may be coming in as well. So we're really changing the whole paradigm of how security can be conducted, not just in healthcare, but across all industries. And we're doing that through this concept of you know, intent-based security, understanding how applications are supposed to work, where users are supposed to be accessing, what data that they should have access to, and knowing that organizations can't protect everything in one fell swoop, but they have to focus on what's most important to their organization.
Oh, perhaps you could give us some practical examples of what virtualization can do for the maintenance of that kind of security. In other words, when I'm looking at maintaining a very sensitive database of information, what can I do with a virtualized environment that I couldn't do with a more traditional environment? In other words, what does VMware have to offer someone who might be developing a solution that will have to deal with contain, store, manage, admin, health information?
Sure. So as we're abstracting that service and the data out from the physical hardware itself and putting it into that virtual environment, we're getting a much more robust visibility into the data itself, or into how the data is being used, or how those workflows and those workloads are being traversed across the network. What that allows us to do now is abstract some of the security services that would normally be in a physical hardware box and bring them into the hypervisor. And a great example is one of the solutions that we have in place is NSX, so our virtualized networking components. We can actually micro segment off those services to ensure that least privilege is taking place in what we calling a zero trust. We're not going with a trust but verify model anymore, but we're going with a zero trust model. And what we're doing is we're mapping all the ports, all the protocols, understanding who needs access, what device, even from a geographic perspective, where they should be coming in, and only allowing the right access at the right time. And what that's going to do is really minimize the threat landscape to an organization. It's not going to remove the entire threat. I don't think at any point in time anybody's going to be able to remove the entire threat. But if we minimize that threat landscape, we can actually detect things bad that are happening because we know what the known good state is. So we're looking for variability. And then secondly, we can respond in a much more timely manner, and we can isolate that traffic. And we're not just doing it ourselves. And one key takeaway here that I want to give about VMware is that we realize that we're not the end-all be-all. We do rely on an integrated ecosystem of partner organizations, because there are just some things that they do better than we do. And what we want to do is extend those services to those partner organizations to create a much more secure environment across the entire enterprise.
Right. Oh, we've got Emily the Strange in our chat room. She's a longtime listener of the show. And she's wondering, wait a minute, this sounds like what VMs do in general. VMs are very good at segmenting off information. So why does VMware have you? Why do they have someone with that kind of experience in the healthcare industry? In other words, what's unique about VMware's flavor of VMs that allows me to, say, meet HIPAA requirements more easily?
Well, I think we're just giving people the opportunity now to really modernize their data centers and start to take advantage of new opportunities to have that digital transformation. And one of the things that VMware is very focused on is opening those walls to create a simplified operating environment to take advantage of the automation that we've built into the portfolio. And then finally, really extend that out to a hybrid cloud environment. we want to really cut the cost out of the operating environment for all organizations. We want to do it in a holistic way that's inclusive of everybody. So if you want to extend a workload and you want to do it securely out to an Amazon Web Services or the hosting center of your choice based upon what your operational commitments are or what the talent is on your bench, you can do that using like tools across that continuum with that VMware solution.
All right. Okay, now I can understand this. This is a nice abstraction of the security that I would have to put into place in order to protect the data of my network. Mm-hmm. There's the other side, though, and that is the usability by people who are actually going to be providing healthcare services. I mean, one of the issues is the fact that I need to operate in an environment where a lot of people need to have a lot of access to that sensitive information. They may not be the most tech-savvy people on the planet. They may have an archaic way of doing things. They may have a very specific process of dealing with information that does not mesh well with an automated system. Is that something that VMware looks at? I mean, your department specifically, are you just involved with creating systems that can secure data, or are you actually looking at your clients and saying, okay, I understand you need to work in this particular way. Let's see what we can do to our solution to tailor it to how you work.
So the beauty about what we're doing in healthcare particularly, we're bringing folks like myself onto the team at VMware, and I spent 10 years as a healthcare chief information security officer, and the rest of my team also has very deep roots in the C-suite across healthcare. We're understanding what the workflows are in a healthcare environment, and we're tailoring the solutions and the innovation to meet the demands of that changing landscape. And when you say, well, what's VMware doing in that space? We're very much focused on the consumer's experience. And what I mean when I say the consumer's experience is it's not just the care provider anymore. It's not just a focus on that doctor or that nurse who's providing care at the bedside. It's also a focus truly on how is that patient interacting with the technology also. If you think about the changing model or the changing landscape for healthcare delivery and how they're actually making money in the long run and instead of keeping their doors open, the quality of the care actually matters. So it's really bringing the patient and the provider together to have a seamless experience with the technology, knowing that there is a risk in the background and we're going to have to address that risk and we have to have some fluidity because the provider needs the right information in their hands at the right time, regardless of where they are, to make an informed decision about patient care. So we're taking all of that into consideration, we're developing a model of zero trust, and it's really not about the user not having access to the back end. And we know that users are the weakest link normally when it comes to security, and especially in a healthcare environment, as they need that information at their fingertips right here, right now. We're really looking at the entire ecosystem of technology and how it interacts with one another. So should that virtual desktop or should that mobile device have access to a database on the back end within your data center? Absolutely not. So what we're able to do is abstract the security out of that and prevent that access from taking place, see that that access does take place or it's attempting to take place, and then take an action upon that access that's trying to take action.
Oh, Chris, we have seen and heard many stories about hospitals and healthcare systems over the last couple of years, and most of them have been horrific. They've been examples of either hospitals that don't know how to use technology and have everything on paper and don't take advantage of automation at all, even when the hospital has spent millions of dollars to upgrade. Or there are examples of a hospital that gets too much into their technology and they've just opened up security holes galore that allow everyone to have access to the sensitive information. Then there's the newer threat, the one that's only happened within the last 18 months or so, where you've got these sensitive systems that get crypt-locked because they didn't have the right security within the network. Now, unfortunately, that seems to be the environment in which healthcare technology exists. And although I understand that VMware can do a great job with making sure that those services are separated out and that they're tailored to the people who are actually using them, we need assurances. We need to hear that the technology that's coming out now, the automation that's coming out now, won't be either an overshare or an invitation to lock down all this information. What is VMware doing in that space?
Well, I'll tell you right out of the gate, technology is not going to solve a majority of that problem. It really starts with people first. then process, and then the technology. And holistically, that's the approach that we look at anytime we walk into a new organization or even an older organization that we've done a lot of work with in the past, to make sure that they have the right people in place, that they have the proper process to handle incidents as they come in, and then where does the technology fit into play to meet the mission of that organization. And I'll be the first one to tell you, there is never a silver bullet to security. There's never a silver bullet to automation. It can cause problems in the long run, but if you do it correctly and start with the people, then the process, and then layer in the technology, you have a much more higher success rate than those who adopt the technology much more quickly and don't look at the people in the process.
All right. I want to go ahead and bring my co-hosts back into the conversation because I've been watching them thoughtfully bombing their heads in the preview monitor. Luz, let's start with you. We did have a discussion earlier about how IoT is continuing to grow. IoT security is continuing to grow, which is fantastic because that's been long lacking. But IoT is also a hot healthcare topic. It's an area in which they're realizing, wow, we can tie all of the sensor data back into a database and it can be protected just like any other HIPAA-protected database. What do you think VMware could do for that, to bolster those efforts, to make sure that IoT security is included and IoT functionality is part of the package?
I think anytime you distribute security and you create abstraction layers, you're going to add layers of security to the device. And so I think that that's kind of where VMware can come into play there, is you're adding a layer of abstraction, you're adding an additional layer of security that doesn't need to be maintained by the user. You're definitely making things more secure. So this third party services, well, there are some out there that do this already, where data is not stored on the device and so on and so forth. But in the same sense, getting this ability to virtualize that, it makes things better. So I think there's always a sense and there's always a capability to add more layers.
Right. Chris, what about that? So adding layers to make sure that IoT is included and protected.
So there. I want to make one clarifying point, because when we talk about IoT in a healthcare setting, I like to actually call it IOMT. So it's the Internet of Medical Things.
And
it's two
sense. Yeah.
Very, very different categories. So we have the legacy-based medical devices, which is top of mind for most health systems today, just because the nature of the vulnerabilities that are impactful within those devices, some of the FDA guidance that protects those manufacturers. And then if you go to the other side of it, we have the standard IoT-based things, which aren't medical devices per se, but hospitals have been using for a long, long time. And I'll give you a classic example, is that we used to monitor the temperatures in our refrigerators that housed our cancer medications. We paid very close attention to them because those drugs cost a lot of money. And if we had to have somebody go around and check all those refrigerators by pen and paper, it would be a lost cause for us. At one point in time, one of those fridges would die disastrously and we'd lose a lot of money.
It actually did. So that was a story that just came out. There was several million dollars of medication that they had to throw out because a refrigerator had broken and nobody knew for a few days.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're balancing the needs of both of those within a healthcare system, which is completely different than most other industries if you start to lay them down apples to apples. And I think what we're starting to see, and where we're starting to see a lot of push with the VMware technologies and the solutions, the innovations that we're bringing to the table, is that we're utilizing edge gateways to manage, monitor, and abstract the data and then secure those tags, those standard IoT tags. And that's going to be critical if you think about how we're transitioning patient care outside of the hospitals and into the home. So if I can send a patient home with some sort of device that's standard IoT-based to gather a measurement or monitor that individual to make sure that they're taking their medication or they're getting up and actually staying active, I can prevent them from coming back in the hospital. The only way I'll be able to do that is abstract that data and get it into that edge gateway and then report back on it. When it comes to the medical devices, though, we can still use those edge gateway technologies to abstract the data that's flowing to it, but we can't touch the device itself. So we're really at this crossroads where we're first and foremost, we want organizations to understand the data, or not even the data, but the devices that they have out there, because I think that's one area of visibility that a lot of organizations don't have today, is they just don't know what they have on their networks. So when they have that firm grasp of everything that's talking within that flat network that they've built out, now how do we control the data that flows to those devices? And that's where I think the abstraction of networking services through those edge gateways starts to play and fall in line with actually protecting the data as it flows, and then protecting the data that gets to that device.
Yeah, I could see that. And that actually makes sense. That's sort of a roadmap for how you design a system to protect your patient data. Curtis, let me bring you in here, because, well, we've talked a lot about HIPAA regulations over the last couple of years, and it's almost one of these magic subjects. Anytime you bring in HIPAA compliance, it stops the conversation, and you have to look around and say, oh, dang it, where am I not HIPAA compliant? How do we separate this data out? Because, I mean, this has actually been one of the challenges when we've looked at systems and networks that have to have a HIPAA-compliant database, but it's also side-by-side with non-HIPAA-required databases and databases that just have general information. This is something that every CTO and every CIO who has this kind of privileged information needs to deal with at some point in their careers, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not dissimilar from the kind of information that financial organizations who are PCI compliant and other organizations that regularly maintain stores of sensitive, personally identifiable information have to deal with. It's just that HIPAA managed to hit a particular industry that wasn't accustomed to this kind of regulation and scare the ever-loving crap out of them. And, on the whole, that's been a good thing. Now, as far as the executives, I think the big thing there is making sure that you clearly understand which information is sensitive, which does fall under the HIPAA regulations, and which doesn't. Not every single bit of information about every single person who might be contained in a database is going to fall under HIPAA. And there are transfers of information that are allowed within HIPAA that don't require you to jump through huge heaps. I mean, by and large, the rule is if data is being transferred between organizations and individuals directly responsible for an individual's health care, you're cool. The part that's tough is trying to make sure that that information stays within those organizations. And the other part is that when all this started, I have some personal experience with systems, call it 15 years ago, that were leaky as sieves in healthcare organizations. So there was a long way to come. I'm curious, though, because when you're talking about the usability of systems, you have the usability expectations of, say, someone in the billing department. Then you have the usability expectations of physicians. And I'm curious, when you're looking at systems, do you build systems with different levels of usability, or do you find that it's best to sort of strike a happy medium and then hope that the younger generation of physicians and healthcare providers are just going to be equal to the task of learning how to use the darn computers?
Yeah. Chris, we are actually running out of time, but I wanted to give you some little runway here. To offer a little bit of wisdom for those in our audience who might be looking at dealing with HIPAA regulations, for those who might be building out systems and networks for organizations that have to deal with HIPAA regulations, what practical advice do you want to give them? What are the things that they should look for? What are the problems that they don't see yet that they are going to have? And what are the opportunities that they might be able to reach?
So that's a lengthy question and could easily be consumed with a 30-minute response, but I'm going to leave the folks with this. I think it's really a case of getting back to proper cyber hygiene. And what do I mean when I say proper cyber hygiene? You know, look at a model that really addresses least privilege, not just from a user's perspective, but from a workload perspective also, even all the way down to the hardware level. What should be accessed and why it should be accessed, really understanding what that data is and what level of security that data may need. Secondly, segmentation. I think what you'll see in a lot of healthcare entities and healthcare organizations is very flat networks. And those flat networks lead themselves to a lot of east-west traffic across the data center. So once an endpoint is compromised, it then has a magnificent journey across your data center to find your crown jewel. So segmentation has to be there. Encryption in this day and age, if you're not using it, I don't know why. And we should probably have a long conversation about why. One of the last things is multi-factor authentication. We've seen a lot of breaches take place, not just remotely, but internally, to access data that probably should have had some level of multi-factor authentication attached to it. And finally, the one that is the most important, the most mind-boggling at the same time is patching. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. It just costs you some operational cycles most of the time to patch. And most organizations are well behind on the patching. And that's one area where if they just took a little bit of time to develop a process and put the right people behind it, they could solve a lot of their risk, and they could actually minimize their threat landscape just through the simple use of patching.
There we go. We've been speaking with Chris Logan. He is the senior healthcare strategist at VMware. Chris, I want to thank you very much for sharing your time with the Twite Right. If you could, please tell people where they can find you, where they can find VMware, and where they can find your wisdom in healthcare.
So you can find VMware everywhere, right? I'm just going to leave that right where it is, but VMware.com. You can find me out on Twitter at LoganCM77, and that's where I tend to share a lot of my knowledge and look to actually find people who are like-minded to help solve problems to deliver the best product possible to technology industry and also to healthcare.
Chris, again, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you very much.
And folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 unsecured HIPAA-containing databases. I want to thank everyone here who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts, without whom I would not want to do this show. Let's start with you, Curtis. Where can people find you, and what are you up to other than making sure you get into the right home?
Well, the best place to find me, of course, is Dark Reading. I'm writing once or twice a day over there, and I am tweeting. So if you want to know when I'm writing, please feel free to follow me at the Twitter handle that's down there. One of the things that I'm going to be doing, as I said, I'm going to be at RSA all next week. I'll be tweeting from there. And I've got a story coming out next week, probably Wednesday morning. Can't say too much about it, but it looks at a fascinating group of cyber pirates and what was done to find them, what they're doing, and why they are still in action today. So be looking for that over at Dark Reading. And if you're going to be in San Francisco at the show, please look me up. Always happy to shake the hand of and say hello to members of the Twiat Riot.
And I wish I could be there with you. You're going to be in my hometown, and I will be out again. And by the way, just remember, the last day of VMworld coincides with the big marijuana celebration in San Francisco. So you may want to avoid Golden Gate Park. Just going to throw that out there. Just going to say, because I'm not sure how good that is for security. Yeah, it's fire. Also, we need to thank Lou Maresca. Now, Lou, I have it on good authority from communications I've received during the course of the show that you're actually going for kids number 6 soon because you want a complete basketball team plus the bench warmer. When can we expect to see team Maresca take the court?
I think that the baby making machine is going to slow down here. I think that's going to happen because we are running on just kindling here. So we'll see what happens. We'll see how that happens in the years to come.
Oh, where can people find you and your work?
So you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM, and of course all my work at Microsoft is dev.office.com. And of course, get ready for Microsoft Build on May 7th. All that cool stuff coming out from there as well.
Indeed. I don't know if you've all read the announcement, but it is public. So I thought we should talk a little bit about here. I wish Tubert was on the show at the moment, but Lou actually will be taking over as the primary host of This Week in Enterprise Tech when I leave mid-June. I'm very happy about that. The entire crew stays on. We're going to have Curtis. We're going to have Tubert. It's nothing that you haven't seen before. But Lou, I'm very interested in finding how you're going to tweak the show to match your personality. What do you got in store for the Twilight Riot?
Well, you know, I've always wanted to target a little bit more of the startup industry as well from the enterprise perspective. So that's, maybe we'll kind of integrate a little bit of that into the show as well.
That'll be a lot of fun. Lou, Curtis, thank you so very much. And thank you for all the wisdom that you shared with This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thanks to you. That's right, you, the person who's watching, the person who's listening, the person who drops in every week to get your dosage of enterprise goodness. We wouldn't have a show without you. We want to make it a little easier for you to get your Twiat dose. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. That's T-W-I-E-T, This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you'll find all of our back episodes, where you'll also be able to download those episodes and see the notes. If there was a story that we covered that you want to read more about, if there was a guest that we had that you'd like to contact, that's the place to go. Again, twit.tv/Twiat. And as long as you're there, why not subscribe? You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version automatically downloaded into your device of choice. And it's a great place to support the show and perhaps share it with your friends. Also, don't forget that you can find me on social media, specifically on Twitter. Go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, follow me, and you'll see what I'm doing when I'm not working here at Twit. Like, for example, having a nice hot cup of Fusroda. And if you don't know what that means, you need to look it up because it's hilarious. Also, don't forget that you can see all the goodness here every Friday live at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv. And if you are watching live, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. You'll notice that we take questions straight out of the chat room. It's a great way for you to be involved with the show and actually ask questions of our guest. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes the show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have let us continue to do Twiat for all these years, to our engineering crew, Alex and John and Burke, who make sure everything's plugged in, and yes, to our technical director, our TD, Kevin the Shark. Kevin, do you got an open mic? Because this is normally the time when I offer you a chance at redemption to see if you were paying attention to the show.
I'm here.
All right, here we go. So here's a little bit of a wisdom coming from today's show. And that is, when you're looking at VMware, what is the main, the premier show that happens every year that displays all the new advances in VMware technology, security, and policy?
It's called...
Google faster.
NSX.
Wow. Okay, this is not just look at random parts of the doc and read them off. I'm sorry, the answer you were looking for was VMworld, which will be happening at the end of August this year.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll be there. It'll be fantastic. Kevin, maybe next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballister, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.